Hello, I'm Kirsty Young, and this is a podcast from the Desert Island Discs archive. For rights reasons, we've had to shorten the music. The programme was originally broadcast in 2003, and the presenter was Sue Lawley.
My castaway this week is an architect. He might have been a musician or a mathematician or a philosopher, but architecture has become the chosen form through which he expresses the ideas contained in all these different disciplines. He was born in Poland into a Jewish family devastated by the Holocaust, and after an academic career won an architectural commission to design a building that evoked that heritage, the Jewish Museum in Berlin. This jagged, inspirational building put him in the front rank of modern architects, helping him to win commissions in this country for the Imperial War Museum in Salford and the extension to the V&A. Then in March this year, he won the competition to design the scheme that will replace the Twin Towers in New York, the phoenix that will rise from ground zero. Architecture, he says, is the one profession in which you can't be a pessimist. He is Daniel Liebeskind. What do you mean by that, Daniel? By inference, that means that you're an optimist, huh?
You have to be if you're going to be an architect, because architecture is always dealing with something constructive. It's about construction. It's about making life better. It's about the future. If you didn't believe in the future, you couldn't build. You would just withdraw. You could write. You could sing. But you could not build.
It's too permanent, too physical.
It's permanent, physical. And the very word construction means that one is endeavoring to make something that will create foundations for the future.
On the other hand, people might look at your Jewish Museum in Berlin and say, what an incredibly sad building. You know, it's zinc and concrete. It has staircases that lead to blank walls. It's unheated. Light just manages to peep through somewhere, but not always. There's a great void in the middle of it. It's the kind of building that's made people cry and does make people cry, isn't it?
Well, it has to be both. Architecture has to have the full range of emotions, particularly when it refers to issues of history. Jewish history in Berlin is not an easy history. Therefore, the building really has those dimensions as well. But it also has that light. And light brings something from the outside, something which is not of the building, something that is of the future and brings hope to that whole history. Otherwise, there would be no use speaking about the past because it would be disconnected from what we do today.
So the optimism is in the attempt to create some kind of reconciliation, is it, with Germans and Jews and the past?
Not so much reconciliation, but an understanding of that history, an understanding that time moves on, that we cannot just be nostalgic and be stuck in some past, but that we have to take responsibility, you know, in an ethical, in an architectural way, for what that time passage means.
Mm. But there is a form of optimism there, isn't there? In the Garden of Exile, as you call it, there are these 49 great vertical columns set at a strange angle as if you're on board a ship, and I think that that's a symbol for you, isn't it?
It is. Those pillars are what I remembered from arriving by ship to New York. It is about the verticality and that amazing feeling that you've left everything behind that you have known, your language, everything, and you're new, and yet everything has changed but has remained the same because you are still with your hopes and dreams there.
And you were 13 years old, on board a ship, sailing in. There was that Manhattan skyline, which is something you talked about a lot when you won the Ground Zero project competition, wasn't it?
I was reminded, it was palpable to me because what happened in Lower Manhattan, the devastation of the World Trade Center, reminded me of what Manhattan really meant to me when I came there. And I came like millions of immigrants on a boat, 4 o'clock in the morning, seeing the Statue of Liberty. And it was just amazing. Out of the mist came that skyline, and that skyline is unfathomable. Actually, you know, even if you've seen films, as I have, and read books about New York and seen the images, there's nothing that prepares you for what it will mean to you. And as an immigrant, it means everything. It doesn't just mean that huge amount of steel and glass and concrete, but it means all the hopes that you have. It means, you know, a new place, a land of opportunity, a place where you can think freely. It was something amazing.
And will your new building, and you will build when it's built, the tallest tower in the world, as it turns out, because it's going to be 1,776 feet high, which is the 1776, date of American independence. Will that show up as people sail in above the Statue of Liberty?
Absolutely. I actually created that composition, I have to tell you the truth, from that vantage point, of a ship. Although most people now arrive by airplanes to Kennedy or to Newark Airport, I thought that eternal almost perspective of the gateway of America in New York with the Statue of Liberty is where those buildings should really form that spiraling movement, and they spiral up to that Great Tower, the Freedom Tower, the 1776 Tower, and all of those buildings, high-rise buildings, really answer the call of the Statue of Liberty, which is a kind of spiral structure in itself with its flame, with its inspiring movement towards the land.
So you went out there in a boat, did you, and sat there and looked at it and thought, that's what I want to do.
I didn't have to go back by boat. That image is so engraved in my mind. It's permanently there. It's not something that I had to go by boat, although I took my daughter there, of course.
Okay, let's pause there for the first of your 8 Desert Island Discs. What's the first one to be?
The first one is the opening of Mozart's Requiem, one of the most incredible, I think, pieces of music ever written.
And incredibly sad.
Well, it's both. It's sad, and yet glimmering in that sadness is a light that isn't coming from any expected source, and yet it's a source of the future of the Requiem.
You wanted just that very short bit of that, Daniel. Why?
Before the singing starts, because it summarizes almost like a huge novel, or it summarizes the whole world. Everything that will happen subsequently, and the singing comes in. But I thought that those bars are really an amazing compression of everything. It's very architectural as well.
That's the opening of Mozart's Requiem, then, played by the Chorus and Orchestra of the Academy of Ancient Music, conducted by Christopher Hogwood. So you might have been a musician, Daniel. Am I right in thinking you gave concerts as a really very small boy, didn't you?
I did, and that's actually one of the pieces of music I remember hearing quite often.
But this was in Poland as
well? In Poland?
What?
Well, I started playing on the accordion when I must have been 5 years old. Hardly could hold it.
So how old were you when you performed?
6, 7, 8. Yeah. And I performed till I was 16, 17.
But there was a reason for the accordion, wasn't there?
There was. It's a strange and in a way a sad reason, because I wanted to play the piano. And, you know, after the war, Poland was quite anti-Semitic, and we were Jewish. We did not hide our Jewishness. My parents spoke Yiddish on the streets. We kept our identity. And my parents are afraid to bring the piano to the courtyard, they told me, because of the neighbors. There was a huge anti-Semitism in Poland, even during these years.
Because you weren't born till 46. You weren't
born till after the war.
So, but it was still that strong,
was
it?
Of course,
in
very
the 50s.
Strong. Very strong. And my parents said, we don't want the neighbors to see that we're bringing a piano. So we'll get you a small one inside of a suitcase, which you can hide away.
An unrecognizable shape. I suppose a violin case might have been.
But this was a kind of anonymous shape. You could sneak it in and no one would say a word. And that's how surreptitiously I played a piano, which was illegal.
Your parents had survived the war because they'd escaped to the Soviet Union. It's where they met, because they were interned there in a concentration camp.
Well, they were both in concentration. They were first under the Nazis in the ghettos, and then they were some among the, quote, lucky Jews who escaped, but they were immediately rearrested. My father was put in the camps on the Volga, cruel labor camps, but my mother was shipped off to Siberia. She was in the Gulag, which is described by Solzhenitsyn under the worst conditions, wearing newspapers on her feet in the snows. So she never quite recovered. But that was a fate. And then when they were released from his camps, after the Polish government exile made a pact with Stalin, they met up. They didn't know each other. They met up in the most remote region of the world, which is in Kyrgyzstan. And I said, why did you go there? They said, well, we just walked wherever it was warmer than where we were. And they wound up near Tibet, China. And then when the war ended, they took a 9-month train ride. And I was born immediately after, and the Polish borders closed, and the Cold War started.
But they were lucky in the sense that when they got back to Poland, obviously they had survived, but the rest of the family, both their families, hadn't.
Well, lucky, yes, they were lucky in a sense, but little did they know the extent of devastation. My father came from a family of 10 brothers and sisters. Only his sister survived Auschwitz. My mother also. So my father once counted 88 members of the immediate family, not considering second, third cousins, perish. So, it was a survival, but of a different kind.
Mm. And you said that your boyhood in Poland, I mean, beyond the family, which, as you say, was, of course, very small, and your music was pretty grim.
It was grim, you know, because we had no one. And we used to call aunt and uncle complete strangers. You know, I didn't grow up with any family members. And growing in Poland wasn't easy for us. Under communism, being who we were, not sort of blending in, we were hounded. My mother had a small shop. She was a seamstress. She was had one of the, they call it private initiative, and she was hounded by the police. I remember the police were always in this little shop, you know, checking who knows what for needles and pins. But it was a strange post-war life in that country.
So how and when did you get out?
We left in the late 50s when Jews were allowed to leave, even expelled, I would say, because the passports were taken away. And we were able to leave to Israel.
You went to Israel?
To Israel, yes. Oh, it was amazing.
What a contrast.
Nothing could be more foreign to someone coming from that part of the world than to wind up literally in the desert. We came, you know, by train through to Venice. We caught a boat, a Greek boat, to Haifa. And then we were put in a place called Hadera, which is now a thriving city. But at that time, it was literally a desert with tents. And we were totally shocked and so happy. We were in a completely new milieu, and we just couldn't believe that all these people on the streets were Jews, that the policemen were Jews, that, you know, the laborers, the farmers. We just couldn't believe there was such a beautiful country there.
Tell me about your second record.
Well, the second piece is the Emerson String Quartet playing one of my favorite. It was the B-flat major fugue from the String Quartet.
The Emerson String Quartet playing part of the fugue from Beethoven's String Quartet in B-flat major. You switched, Daniel Libeskind, from the accordion to the piano when you got to Israel and it all became possible. I mean, the keyboard it has in common, but otherwise it's a completely different instrument, isn't it?
It is, and I never actually kind of recovered because, you know, when I received my scholarship, the head of the jury was Isaac Stern, and he said to me, you know, because I was the only person competing on an instrument. Everybody else was playing the piano or the violin or the cello.
And he's probably the only one ever to have won that scholarship.
Probably,
on the accordion.
Probably. And he said to me, you know, Mr. Lipskin, you've already totally exhausted all the possibilities. You know, you should definitely now play the piano. Mm. But really, I was an accordionist, actually.
Yes.
And a virtuoso on an instrument. And I played with classical musicians. I didn't play at sort of tango festivals. And I didn't play those kinds of things. I did play my own transcriptions of basically Baroque music.
You ended up playing in Carnegie Hall. Was that on the accordion or on the piano?
On an accordion.
Right.
Absolutely on the accordion. Town Hall and the accordion.
Yeah.
Definitely.
And is that why? Because you won the competition in Israel.
Won the competition,
and then
I continued to play it.
Won the scholarship. Is that why the family moved from Israel to New York?
No, I think there were other reasons, but certainly winning the scholarship was a wonderful thing for our family.
So 2 years later, so you were 13, as we said, when you arrived
in New York.
But eventually, you gave it up. You stopped playing. You stopped playing, even though you'd reached great heights playing in Carnegie Hall. Now, why?
Personally, I don't think I ever really gave it up. In some sense, what I do now, which is drawing and building and making architecture, is an extension of a sensibility that I acquired through playing music.
Hmm. But was it also, you know, a desire to be the best at whatever you might do? Because you were playing alongside Daniel Barenboim, for example.
Sure, it was sort of nobody told me that you should be the best, but that was kind of part of a sensibility, not to just play as a hobbyist, not just to play for yourself, but to play for others. And part of playing is acquiring a technique which cannot be bought somewhere. You have to do it yourself by practicing and practicing and practicing, and that goes actually for everything. You have to be committed to it if you are going to rise above just a medium level of the everyday.
Mm. So you moved away from it. You moved into mathematics and then into architecture. Do you still play?
No. I don't.
When did you last touch an instrument, the accordion or the
piano? Probably when I was about 17.
Not even for your own amusement?
No, it's hard. You know, I've thought about it a lot. If you perform for audiences, it's very hard to perform for yourself. I never thought of it as something that was amusement. I never thought of music as an amusing thing. I never thought it's just something to do for fun. I thought it's an extension of a certain spirit, and then I can't do it if it's not that spirit.
And your music is in your architecture, as we shall discuss, and as you've said. Let's hear record number 3. What's that?
Number 3 is actually 3 fragments from ancient Greek music. These are fragments reconstructed from ancient manuscripts. So they're not inventions, but actual ancient Greek music, which is, whether it's apocryphal or not, I love it.
Three fragments from ancient Greek music played by the Music Atrium of Madrid, conducted by Gregorio Paniagua. You're obviously, Daniel, an idealist. I think when you met your wife, you said that you'd never work for another architect, you'd never do a house renovation, and you'd never sell your ideas for money. I presume you've reneged on the last one.
No, I don't sell my ideas for money. Of course, you have to support an office if you're going to build buildings. But I followed pretty much a path that I got onto.
And certainly you've done your own thing. I mean, you taught for a long time, and you taught in Milan, Harvard, Yale, Canada, Finland. How many times have you and the family moved in your 30, 35 years?
I think my wife says she already has a PhD in moving. It's the only PhD she has. But we must have moved at least 15 times and many of those times across the Atlantic, back and forth to different countries.
Mm, huge number of times. And for 2 decades, you never built a building. And then, certainly not a kitchen extension. And then in 1989, you won this competition to build the Jewish Museum in Berlin. You'd have been, what, 43 at the time, something like that. Did you, it sounds like a silly question, did you intend to win it? Did you enter competitions because you enjoyed the exercise?
No, I never entered competitions just for the exercise. I entered this one quite by chance. Somebody told me about it and said, you know, there is such a competition for a Jewish museum. What do you? And I said, you're kidding. That's something that I would absolutely drop everything and start working on.
Except that it meant you had to move to Berlin, which must have been a very painful decision.
Well, I didn't know. At the time when I entered the competition, I had no intention to move to Berlin. People thought we were absolutely insane. No one had an intention to build such a building. There was no money for such a building. They said, why are you here? What are you doing here?
But also your family found it rather difficult to understand.
Of course. Well, somebody from my background.
Nature of the history. Sure.
Definitely. Somebody from my background. Well, we avoided Germany before, I have to be honest. We never stayed there. We never came to visit.
Could you speak German?
No, I spoke Yiddish, which is close enough to German. But when we moved, we were almost disowned by our family. They thought, how horrible. What are these people doing? But it was an important move because
Your father came, though, eventually.
My father came,
he?
And he appreciated it. And then and he was already an old man in his 80s when he first came. And then other members of the family came. They said, you know, you did the right thing. Time does change.
But did he say when you walked him around that museum? Because when it was finally built, I mean, he must have been 90 by then.
Yes. Well, he was very proud. And he said, you know, this is standing for something that is alive, the Jewish culture. It's here. We are standing here. And he was very proud. He was very moved by the fact that memory, and at the same time, the fact that it has a future, that there were new people on the streets, that there was blue sky, and the world had changed for the better. and that one wasn't stuck any longer in that image that one has that is never changing of the tragedy that prevailed. So, yes, he saw the future coming.
Record number four.
Record number four is Pfat by Giancinto Scelsi. I like it because actually it's not a composition, more like a dissemination of a spherical space of density.
That was part of Fat, or Fat, PFH, there by Giacinto Scelsi, played by the Radio Television Orchestra of Krakow, conducted by Jörg Wittenbach. Does it just go on like that?
He's a very interesting composer because he sort of broke out of the linear idea of music into a different modality, and I like it. It's very metaphysical space that he creates, and I think one has to listen to the whole thing actually to get it complete.
Okay, so your belief, self-evidently, Daniel, is that the form of a building should not only be informed by its function, but also by the history of the site it's on and the story that it's trying to tell. Describe to me how that applies to your Imperial War Museum of the North in Salford, which opened last year.
Well, the Imperial War Museum is based I took the earth, and it's shattered and broken into shards, fragments of the spherical globe. And the fragments are re-erected in space. So there's the vertical, the air shard, which is the entrance to the museum and observatory, the horizontal shard, which is convex, which is where the great museum spaces are, and the concave shard on the ship canal, which is the restaurant.
So sort of scooping straight down to the Manchester ship canal.
So it's a composition that isn't just really functionalistically thought about, but architecture has to have a kind of an emotional impact as well. It's partly how these inert materials, steel and concrete, communicate to a person in a deep way.
But of course,
conflict is something that is not obvious.
The shattering is obvious.
And what are the implications of that shattered globe? How does it come back together? What happens?
So your design is conceptual in that sense, and you're always looking for a symbol. And we also mentioned that now your music is in your buildings. I mean, one can see that in the sense of harmony. You create a kind of harmony in your buildings. How else do you see? I mean, people talk about architecture being frozen music.
But think of the shattered globe. I remember a fragment of a letter by Mozart, where someone asks him what his music is like. And somewhere he says, it's like a breaking of a glass on a Viennese floor. You know, it's kind of the whole music is compressed in that sound of vulnerability, but also the echo of what it really all means in that space. Mm-hmm. So, yes, I think music and architecture are very closely related. And certainly the echoes and feelings that a building evokes are part of its communicative power.
It's certainly a very public performance, isn't it?
It's a public performance, and it's not just about symbols. It's about communicating the deeper ideas, which are, of course, part of the body as well. We don't just think with our heads. We have to walk. We have feet. We have hands. Oh. We have eyes. We have ears. Even the acoustical quality of a space gives a certain communication, which is often underestimated.
And we have emotions, you know, something either hits the right spot for us or it doesn't, whether it's music or whether it's a building. And I want to talk to you in a minute about the spiral design for the V&A, because for some people, of course, it hasn't hit the right spot. Let's pause for some more music. Number five now. What's that?
Number five is Vexations. It's a very lengthy piece of music. We'll hear only a fragment by Erik Satie. Thank you.
Alan Marks playing Vexations from Eric Satie's Mystical Pages. It's quite hypnotic, isn't
it? It is. It's like a trance. It's only a few notes that create a complete world that continues forever, because the music actually is meant to be played for 24 hours, repeating. But it's interesting that with each repetition there's a difference. And the music is forever different, even though it is based on the same principles.
Okay, let's talk about the spiral, which you designed for the extension of the V&A Museum in the Brompton Road in Kensington. You certainly got the residents and the burghers going, because they were sort of pretty... Let us describe it first. Would it be fair to say, you know, if you piled up some children's bricks and twisted them and then pushed them over so it looked as if they were going to topple?
No, actually not. Actually, it's a very elegant structure. It's not conventional. It's not just an extrusion of a box, but it's a spiral. It's not round, but it's actually a continuous set of walls for the museum activities, which is also shaping the external spaces of the museum simultaneously, relating itself to the Henry Cole Wing, to the Western Range, to all the buildings which
are
around it.
Because it's to sit between these two arts and crafts buildings, Victorian, 1860s.
Right. Well, those are very bold buildings, and this is not just something glued on to them, but it provides a completely new public space and, of course, connects to those historical buildings.
It's more to do with connection than display, isn't it, apparently?
No, it's both.
You can't really display
in
there.
No, absolutely.
Because it's such a strange shape.
No. We are not only going to be displaying things in a 19th or 20th century way. This is for fashion, for photography, for arts and crafts, for architecture. So we're not any longer talking about just the Cartesian box, you know, hanging on a wall of a 19th century warehouse. This was supposed to be the great museum of the contemporary. And why should we now think that it's for the Queen's dusty jewels? It's for the great objects of the world. And those great social democrats, you know, what did they put on the gateway to Cromwell Road on the V&A? They put the figure of inspiration, the figure of knowledge. And that's exactly what I said, that the spiral is about inspiration and knowledge and takes you into those amazing collections that are second, you know, to none in the world.
More music, number six.
Number six is the Theatertale, the fourth part of Kurt Schwitter's Ursonata.
Tell me about it.
The Ursonata is a kind of a poem, a linguistic tour de force of the voice, actually, reinventing the language of speaking and singing.
Part of the Theatertale, the fourth part of Kurt Schwitter's Ursonate, and that was recorded in the 1920s. I mean, is this sort of stuff you play at home when
absolutely.
The end of a long day's work?
Not only do I play it at home, but my kids are addicted to it. My wife, you know, walks out of the house when I put it on, but the kids love it. And of course, Schwitter was a great visual artist, and it's a kind of voice on the edge of hope, desperation, and human possibility.
And now then, the Ground Zero project. Draw me a word picture of your design for it, if you would. It's a ring of towers to start with.
Well, the Ground Zero is about memory. I call it memory foundations because it, first of all, deals with that site of what happened there, 9/11, the fateful day when thousands of people were killed. And they have to be remembered in a profound way, because the day that they changed the world, we don't travel the same way, we don't think the same way, we don't watch the news in the same way. The world has changed. That date will forever stand for a transformation. And of course, foundations, in the sense that one has to lay foundations for a resurgence of New York, for an optimistic, future-oriented 21st century city that is not going to be second to anyone in the sense of how it's going to reestablish itself at the center of the world.
And that's why you're leaving the foundations exposed to a certain extent.
That's right. Well, I was very moved when I went to the site and I saw those famous slurry walls, which are the foundations of the site.
These are the slurry walls that hold back
back the Hudson River. And they are not only the trace of the attack, but they're also... They speak to communal values. They speak to the bedrock of New York. They speak about democracy. They speak about what withstood and continues to withstand evil acts that are perpetrated by fanatics. So there is something very moving about this site, which relates that history of New York to its future, which, of course, has to reconcile itself with the memorial and create a transition between the memorial and, I proposed, of course, museum buildings, cultural buildings, kind of a nexus that protects the memorial, gives it a spiritual quality, civic quality, and, of course, rises to a pinnacle in the sky, restoring the skyline and giving the public back.
And am I right in thinking that there's one public square created by some of these towers where there will be no shadow at the times between which the aeroplanes...
That's right. There is, it's a grand public space right next to the Lower Manhattan Station, which will also be built there, which I call the Wedge of Light, which is defined by two angles. 8:46 a.m. when the first tower was struck will be illuminated, and 10:28 when the second tower collapsed. At those two times, those two faces will be completely in light, throwing light back into that plaza. Mm. So it's a very special space.
And it's being gone through now, all of your designs. I mean, is it buildable? We know this, do we?
Because of course it's buildable.
Well, of course, we are working on it.
But
engineers have to look at it and actually discover
whether... Of course, there's a lot to be... We are at work, hard at work. We are not just sitting and drawing pictures. We have to work on with large teams and make it all happen.
You've got to get all the right permissions and all those things, but is it going to happen?
It will happen,
of course. And when will it happen?
Well, there's an urgency to it because New Yorkers are not about to live with a devastated site in the middle of one of the greatest cities in the world. So reconnecting the streets, creating a new connection in Greenwich Street, Fulton Street, the Wedge of Light, the Park of Heroes, the memorial itself, the Grand Station, which brings, what, 500,000 people every day to that site and to Wall Street and to Lower Manhattan, and of course restoring the skyline in the Freedom Tower. That is in my plan within 4 years. Mm-hmm. And I thought that one should create a nexus of cultural activities, bring culture, performing arts center, museums, so that this area shines with the light of democracy, light of the free world, and is an inspiration to people who will think forever of that event, but also connect it to the resurgence and the renaissance of New York.
But Daniel Libeskind is moving to New York from Berlin, and he's going to drive this one on just the way he did the Jewish Museum.
Come back to New York, of course, because you can't do this. You have to be embroiled right in the midst of it, and there are so many different stakeholders with different views, and one has to negotiate, one has to be in the center of it and make it happen.
Record number seven.
Number seven is the free jazz improvisation played by Ornette Coleman, double quartet.
Why?
It's a totally improvised music, but it's ingenious. It's
all your pieces are ingenious.
Well, this Ornette Coleman free jazz variations, it is improvised but has a very powerful structure within the freedom that it offers to all the players, and it is just like the modern world.
Part of free jazz played by the Ornette Coleman double quartet. In the meantime, Daniel Libeskind, you're redesigning the piano and you're designing the sets for a production of Rheingold at Covent Garden. I mean, these are your spare time activities.
Yes. Well, it's wonderful. It's all part of a creative opportunity. And why should, you know, the ring be any less important than anything else, or for that matter, the redesigning the piano?
Of course not, but it's the energy that one admires. It just comes naturally to you, obviously.
Well, it's so much fun, actually. It's so joyous to be able to be involved in different scales, you know, from an urban scale that is sort of unfathomable. Who has ever seen a bigger project in a greater sort of area of complexity in the world than New York? And at the same time, something very specific, like a theatrical production or an opera or an instrument.
You're going to be bored out of your mind on this desert island, aren't you?
Well, that's the challenge.
Can you imagine it?
No, I think you can't, because boredom is such an abstract idea. It's only when you sort of slack off that you can be bored. But if you're on a desert island, you would certainly be challenged, not only to survive, but to keep yourself sane.
Tell me about your last record.
The last record is Glenn Gould, my favorite pianist, playing the Goldberg Variations.
Why do you want that?
The intensity of Bach's music and the intensity of Glenn Gould's performance merge together into something that is really transcendental. Thank you.
part of the aria, the opening of Bach's Goldberg Variations played by Glenn Gould. So three questions left, Daniel. First of all, which of those eight records would you take if you could only take one of them?
Oh, that's a tough one. It would probably be the last one because I've already listened to it about a million times and I haven't been bored. So I'm sure that I could listen another 80 million times to it.
The Bach, the Goldberg Variations. What about your book? We give you the Bible, we give you the complete works of Shakespeare.
I would take a text which is actually not written with words, but a book I have, which is a book of drawings of Piranesi. It's called The Prisons. Each one is an imaginary text drawn in an architectural way. It's a kind of strange, almost impossible dream. And it has always been an inspiring book for me. It doesn't have words, but it's a complete text. You can read into it and read out of it many, many things. And I've always thought, if I was to take one book, that would be the book.
And your luxury.
Oh, that's a hard one. I would probably take just a pencil and a piece of paper because I still love the pencil more than the computers that we have in our offices and all the modern implements. And a piece of paper because I could do a lot. I mean, this would be a lot of fun to have it. I could write, I could draw, I could measure.
Daniel Libeskind, thank you very much indeed for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast from the Desert Island Discs archive. For more podcasts, please visit bbc.co.uk/radio4.